And without delay, I will now pass the floor to Professor Christy Ebbe from the University of Washington to tell us, to deliver an overview of the health impacts of climate change. Thanks a lot for being with us, Chris.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you very much to the organizers for inviting me, and thanks to all of you for attending. As you heard, I'm going to run through and do a little bit of an overview about climate change and health. You're going to hear a whole lot more from other experts today and tomorrow. I want to start with a couple of important framing questions. The figure on the right is the framing that's used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And it's used not just in health, it's used in all sectors. And basically it says, as we look into the future is uncertain. There's always uncertainties about what the future could bring. And when we think, particularly in the context of a changing climate, we're looking at risk, where risk is probability times consequence. And risk is composed of three or four main factors, depends on how you divide it up. One are the hazards created by a changing climate. The second are the places and the communities that are affected by those hazards. The third is the underlying vulnerability of those people and those places. And the fourth is the capacity to manage. Often people combine this vulnerability and capacity to manage together. I prefer to keep them separate, but the IPCC likes to put them together. And with that as the framing on the left, you see one of many, many figures that shows what climate change is already doing to our health and is expected to do to our health in the future. You can see at the top some of the factors that are changing. Some of them are driving climate change, some are a consequence of climate change. And those factors interact with a very wide range of demographic, socioeconomic, environmental factors that affect risk pathways, exposure pathways that we're used to looking at in health. And those are listed across the middle. Underneath is a short list of some of the climate-sensitive health outcomes of concern. You can see it's a very long list. I've had the privilege of spending quite a lot of time in low and middle income countries, and these are all of the issues that ministries of health have to cope with. One of the challenges that climate change presents in health is that as you look at all those different climate-sensitive health outcomes, they all have different programs. So there's a program for maternal and child health. There's a program for vector control. There's a program on diarrheal disease. There's a program on disaster risk management. And those are separate line programs within a Ministry of Health. Climate change cuts across all of those, and these all, of course, intersect. And so thinking about how to make our ministries, our health systems, much more effective when we have these large-scale system changes ongoing is an important area of work. I have a couple slides like this. You should never put up a slide with this many words, but I only get about 20 minutes, so I'm going to put up these slides and summaries from the Human Health chapter of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And I highlighted in the lighter blue some of the places where impacts are already being observed, that we're seeing people suffering and dying today from climate change. And so there's a complete assessment in that chapter of all of these different issues. I noted at the bottom something I won't talk much about, but it's health services themselves, that there's many healthcare facilities that are in coastal zones or along rivers that are subject to flooding, to storm surge, to sea level rise. And so we're seeing real disruption in the ability to deliver healthcare services. A topic that was new in this chapter was mental health. There's been quite a lot of research that's come out in the last few years about how climate change, changing temperature, for example, higher temperatures leads to higher rates of suicide in many cultures. And so there's a lot of work being done on what mental health impacts are from a changing climate. This is work that was done in Public Health England from a major flooding event several years ago in the southeast of the country. And you can see the differences Boy, those got washed out. You can see the differences between homes, residences that were flooded, disrupted, and not flooded in the prevalence of depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Those folks have been followed up now for 3 or 4 years, and the prevalence has come down significantly, but there's still differences across the groups, indicating long-term consequences for mental health. We just heard a mention about heat. The Lancet Countdown is an annual publication that goes through about 40 indicators of where we are right now with climate change and health. And this shows you exposure of vulnerable populations, adults over the age of 65, children under the age of 1. And you can see the numbers, that very large increase in the number of person days of exposure. And you can just look at the graph, just significant change since 1980. You're going to hear more about heat later, but I wanted to mention the heat dome as an example. Occurred in the Pacific Northwest last summer, almost exactly a year ago, not quite a year ago. Unprecedented temperatures. These are in degrees Fahrenheit because we're in the US. In Celsius, the maximum temperature record was broken by 5 degrees Celsius. Typically, when temperature records are broken, they're broken by tenths of degrees. It's unprecedented to have them broken by 5 degrees. There is a statistical method called detection and attribution to determine whether an event can be attributed to some extent to climate change. And the assessment was that this event was virtually impossible without climate change. The numbers are still being finalized, but it looks like at least 1,000 excess deaths from this event. 1,000 people who would not have died otherwise. It's interesting when you look at these events. In 2003, you had massive heat waves here in Paris, other parts of France, and the rest of Europe. 70,000 excess deaths associated with those heat waves. And yet we never call them a mass mortality event. If you had any other event in 3 days where 1,000 people died in a pretty small region, there would be much more outcry than there seems to be about heat. The other point I wanted to make is that we need to think about heat as an all of society problem. That it wasn't just the people who died, it wasn't just the 69-fold increase in heat-related hospitalizations, having our emergency departments pretty overwhelmed with managing all the people who come in. It's also the outdoor workers. It's also agriculture. Really affected our wheat crop, it affected our cherry crop. In addition, between Seattle and Vancouver in British Columbia, it's an area called the Salish Sea, and there's a lot of farming of mussels, clams, and oysters. It was low tide, and about 1 million mussels, clams, and oysters cooked in the ocean. And that's food security for many of our tribes, that's livelihoods. And so thinking about all the different impacts of heat and how to best address those. I mentioned detection and attribution. This is a first effort at a modeling detection and attribution for health. Again, it looks at heat-related mortality, looks at 43 countries, and looks at the proportion of heat-related mortality could be attributed to anthropogenic climate change. Over these countries, it's about 37%. You can see huge variability across the countries. But again, underscoring the point that people are dying today from climate change. I live in the Pacific Northwest, so I always have to talk about wildfires. When it's hot, we get wildfires. This is also from the Lancet Countdown, showing you a real increase in the number of days people are exposed to very high or extremely high fire danger, and how that is increasing over time. We know there's lots of health risks from wildfire smoke. I put this in to emphasize the health risks, but also there is the air quality index across the bottom. I don't know if you use an air quality index here, but we use an air quality index. It's a measure of how much particulate matter is in the air, measured as PM 2.5. And you can see above 60 micrograms per cubic meter, the air is unhealthy for anyone to breathe. In my neighborhood, 2 years ago, for 2 straight weeks, our air quality index was over 250. Last summer, there was wildfires outside Los Angeles. There was a community that had an air quality index over 750. These are massive air pollution exposures. I usually ask how many people have hay fever or allergies, and typically it's about a third of people do. And this is from the US, and it just shows the ragweed pollen is now almost a month longer in northern regions. There's been research in Europe that shows the same thing. Spring's coming sooner. Higher temperatures mean that the plants are happy in the spring. They are producing more pollen. And I will also talk in a minute about higher carbon dioxide and how it's affecting plants themselves, in this case, producing more pollen. For projected impacts, there's a shorter list. It's because there's been very little funding in this area, but there are projections, and basically all the projections say with additional climate change, we will see additional impacts unless action's taken on adaptation and mitigation. There is an exception, and I don't know if Cyril's gonna talk about this, but the exception is in parts of Africa. Projections suggest that some parts of Africa will be too hot and too dry for malaria, which sounds like it could be a good thing. But if it's too hot and too dry for the Anopheles mosquito, I doubt they're going to grow anything either. So we need to look at these impacts together, not separately, which is what we've done to date. An example of, for the US, again, is useful because it highlights the importance of both adaptation and mitigation. Obviously, maps of the US, the top row is adaptation, the bottom is no adaptation. The left column is greenhouse gas emissions per usual, the middle is some modest reductions, and the right is aggressive reductions. You can see the significant difference in the increase in heat-related deaths between the top left and the bottom right. So clearly we need both adaptation and we need mitigation. Further, when you look in the bottom right, which is the best scenario, we're still gonna have additional cases of heat-related mortality. We're gonna have what we call residual risk. And so we're going to need to really ensure that we beef up our health systems to be able to manage these kinds of changes. I know you're going to have a great talk on vector-borne diseases. I just put this in to show that temperature and precipitation affect the development, survival, and reproduction of mosquitoes. They also can affect ticks. And that temperature affects the replication as well of the pathogen within the mosquito. So the modeling is fairly complicated because you have to model what temperature and precipitation do to the mosquito, as well as what it does to the pathogen. An interesting point comes from a study again in the US, and this is for the mosquito in the US that can carry dengue fever, chikungunya, Zika virus, and yellow fever. In Europe, you've got Aedes albopictus, we have Aedes aegypti. The map in the upper left shows, based on modeling, on a lot of experiments that were done, the present day distribution of the mosquito, where is the environment suitable in the yellow color on this, and then in the red, where that could expand to under high emissions towards the end of the century. So real significant expansion in the geographic range. Almost all the studies show that with higher temperatures, you can see expansion of the geographic range of many vectors and many ticks. But it's not just having the vector or tick present. You have to have a summer that's hot enough and long enough that you can introduce dengue fever into the population and then start having transmission. And when you take that into account, you can see a much reduced range on the bottom right. I live in Seattle, which in the upper left is a place where we'd see Aedes aegypti. In the bottom right, it says we wouldn't have possibilities for dengue transmission, which all sounds good. However, this was published in 2016, a couple years after this. Breeding colonies of this mosquito were found in Toronto, Toledo, and Detroit, well outside any of these projections. And this is typical of what we're seeing across not just health, but many other sectors of a lot of work is put into models, and the models are unprojecting the rate at which these risks are appearing. This mosquito is 100% adapted to a human environment. Once you've got breeding colonies, there's pretty much nothing you can do about it. I've never done this. Colleagues of mine who are entomologists have done this. Apparently, if you go into sewer systems, there's millions of mosquitoes. It's a great place to overwinter. It's warm, it's moist, they got places to lay their eggs. We put grates in the sidewalk so they can come out and get a blood meal. So once you've got that established, it's almost impossible to get rid of it. Likely the biggest impact of a changing climate is going to be undernutrition. This is from the latest IPCC report. It looks at projected yield changes. The top row is mid-century. The bottom is end of century. It's for maize, rice. I'm not going to talk about soybeans because they're really a lot different. And then wheat. It's under three different scenarios of greenhouse gas emissions. And all I really want you to do is look at the pattern. It just shows you that with higher temperatures, crop yields fall. The number of people who are food insecure has increased in the last couple of years. It got down to around 620 million people worldwide. It's now back up to almost 850. Climate change is part of the reason for that. And crop yields are falling in the places that are most at risk. It's not just the temperature precipitation change, it's also carbon dioxide itself. All of our plants have mechanisms for bringing in carbon dioxide from the atmosphere into the plant, breaking it apart, and using the carbon to grow. 85% of our plants use one photosynthetic pathway. The biochemical characteristics of that pathway mean that these are called C3 plants. I can explain if you want, but just basically it's 85% of our plants. It's wheat, it's rice, it's barley, potatoes, it's grasses. So much of what we consume is considered a C3 plant. With higher CO2, and this is based on field experiments, with higher CO2, these plants do bring in more carbon into the plant. And so you read in some places that carbon dioxide is plant food. And it is, it's plant food. However, we're changing the constitution of the plant. So there's more carbon-based molecules and fewer nitrogen-based molecules. That means you've got more carbohydrates. And at the same time, there's a decline in protein by about 10%, micronutrients 5%, B vitamins about 30%. I mentioned about 850 million people in the world are food insecure. About 2 billion have micronutrient deficiencies. 1.5 billion women and girls have iron deficiency anemia. So these shifts in the plants are projected to affect hundreds of millions of people around the world. And that's before considering the decline in crop yields. I wanted to spend just a moment on this. These are iconic figures that have been used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change since 2001. Based on the color scheme, they're called the burning embers. When you look at these, the zero line are pre-industrial temperatures, the y-axis are increases in temperatures above pre-industrial. And the scientific work that goes into this is to completely assess, either based on the literature or based on expert elicitation, of where to see changes in risk as temperatures rise. Where the color is white, it means it's not possibly scientifically to determine there's been a change, for example, in heat-related mortality. We just can't tell. When the color turns to yellow, it means that there has been an increase in heat-related mortality, and we can attribute some of that risk to climate change. When the color turns to red, the risks are very high, purple, extremely high. And the question is then, as you think about reducing greenhouse gas emissions, in trying to match your greenhouse gas emissions with your impacts, of where do you see a real shift from one level of risk to another? In this case, we looked at four. We actually looked at six, but I'm just showing four of the climate-sensitive health outcomes. And we did this by different scenarios of adaptation. The adaptation scenarios are truncated at the temperature change that is projected for 2100. That's why some of it's shorter. But basically, you can look at any one of these, and you can see how important it is both to mitigate and to adapt. That if we don't mitigate, our risks become very high. If we don't adapt, we're also going to have challenges. And so it's a way to communicate to policymakers about the importance of focusing on both mitigation and adaptation. And it helps answer questions such as, how important is it to keep warming to 1.5 degrees versus keep letting it go up to 2 degrees? And you can see those differences in risk between 1.5 and 2. The Human Health chapter had extensive assessment about adaptation options. You're going to hear a lot about those over the next day and a half. I will not spend more time on this. I probably spent a little bit too much time. I wanted to note one thing at the bottom. A major constraint is limited investment. when you look at all the funds that have been invested to adapt to a changing climate under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, less than 0.5% has gone to health. Similar challenge with research funding. It's not exactly an adaptation option, but it's something that's very, very helpful for decision makers. It's a process called vulnerability mapping. This is some work recently published from British Columbia. And you can see on this slide that the authors developed indicators for extreme heat exposure, sensitivity to that extreme heat, proportion of the population of the age of 65, for example, and the capacity of the communities in British Columbia to manage those higher temperatures. The authors did this not just for heat, but also flooding and sea level rise, Vancouver's coastal, wildfire smoke, and for ground level ozone. Ozone's formed on clear, cloudless days. The rate at which it's formed is temperature dependent. And then they put this all together. And these are the places where it's urgent and immediate to take action. And this is being used by the decision makers to ensure that they focus their funding on where they need it the most. Overall, when one looks at adapting to a changing climate, a critical component is having national adaptation plans for health. This is also from the Lancet Countdown. And you can see in 2021, 91 countries reported, only half of them have some kind of plan. And of those with a plan, very few have high levels of implementation. They don't have the funding. You heard about the significant health benefits of mitigation. This is a publication from the northeast of the US looking just at child health from an initiative in that region to reduce greenhouse gases. And this is by the county level. And you can see just over 5 years, if you can see the little numbers over in the right, in some of these counties, the benefits for children's health was up to $21 million. So huge benefits for health, which need to be articulated. When we hear about mitigation, we hear about the cost of mitigation. We don't hear that we could save all of those costs and improve our health at the same time. I know we're going to talk about research needs, so I put in a slide about research needs. It's a paper that was accepted yesterday. So these are some of the categories where we have significant research needs, which we can come back to if that would be useful. And finally, about 85% of all the health risks of a changing climate are in children. So when you think about climate change and health, please remember all the children. Thank you.